court will proceed to the fourth case of the day, the United States versus Havens. Yeah, I'm going to pass that on. Thanks, Frank. So, Daisy?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Bill Daisy, Indiana Federal Community Defenders. I served as Mrs. Havens' appointed counsel in the district court and continue in that status on appeal. The case comes before the court on direct appeal following guilty pleas to six counts of identity theft-related offenses revolving around a second mortgage taken out by the defendant using the identifiers of someone with better credit refinancing her own home. There were two other debts that were uncharged conduct, one being a second mortgage on the house and one being a credit card. The focus of the sentencing hearing was not restitution. There were two contested sentencing guideline issues. They were thoroughly briefed and argued, and the district court called both of them in favor of the defendant. The complaint or issue concerning the restitution order, in my view, revolves around whether
counsel, why does any of this matter?
It may
Your
be,
client
it
is already under a $44,000 judgment from state court. What difference does it make whether the federal judgment is for $30,000, $10,000, $5,000, or any number as long as it's less than $44,000?
It could be in the long run that it doesn't matter. I would say that there is.
If your client is not adversely affected or aggrieved by the judgment, what makes it appealable? Why should we disturb it?
Two factors. I would argue first that in the event of a bankruptcy proceeding, there is a theoretical difference between the dischargeability of a debt alleged to be incurred through fraud and the dischargeability of a...
No, debts incurred through fraud are not dischargeable and restitution orders are not dischargeable. The treatment in bankruptcy is identical. Yep.
I hope never to argue
it's
another
bankruptcy
case.
The federal judgment is smaller. I just can't see why anything turns on this. You know, there are somewhat different collection procedures that the probation service will hound your client, and different state officials will hound your client until it's paid, but that doesn't, you know, your client has, let's just say your client has no legal interest in having a collection procedure be somewhat more effective because your client owes the money. In fact, under the state judgment, your client owes more than under the federal judgment. Well, I just can't see what difference it makes.
Recognizing first that the court is undoubtedly correct and I am undoubtedly wrong in stating that it requires a creditor's objection and a bankruptcy determination on a debt alleged to have been incurred through fraud and that no such procedure is entailed in dischargeability determination as to a restitution order. I would argue that it is a real difference that during at least a period of 3 years he's subject to threats of incarceration, significant potential collection efforts through the United States probation, while on supervised release with regard to payment of this debt, and the fact that the United States of America then can pursue collection thereafter.
Actually, the United States of America can pursue collection of a state judgment. All that has to happen is it has to be registered in federal court. May need to be diversity. But as I say, I don't understand what your client's legal interest might be in saying it's somewhat more likely the federal judgment will be collected. I actually don't see what the likelihood is that either of them will be collected, because obviously your client can't have any assets or you wouldn't be here.
It would appear the collection is going to be difficult under...
Finally, I don't understand why you are here. Getting in against Wainwright gives criminal defendants a lawyer at public expense to contest incarceration. I've never understood Gideon to allow a contest at public expense to a money judgment, and that seems to be the only thing being contested here.
The money judgment was in a civil court. The order of restitution was imposed by a United States judge, Your Honor.
But so what? There's no entitlement under Gideon to counsel at public expense to contest something, whether it's called a restitution order or a fine or anything other than imprisonment. That's what the Supreme Court held in Argersinger against Hamlin. So I don't understand why the federal government is paying you to contest a money judgment, what amounts to a civil money judgment, especially under circumstances where it doesn't make a dime's worth of difference.
I argue it does make a dime's worth of difference. I argue that for those factors argued in the brief that it does. I consider counsel's duty on appeal to scour the record for non-frivolous issues and to bring those issues before the court. I've done so. I argue the position is correct. I argue the United States District Court, in any case, should not be saddled with an obligation to consider non-monetary harm in fixing an order of restitution in a criminal case, considering such things as inconvenience and angst and that sort of thing in imposing its restitution order. The court is implying that an indigent defendant has no right to seek appeal of a restitution order imposed in a criminal conviction.
No, it's not a question whether they're entitled to appeal. It's a question whether the public fisc pays.
Perhaps fortunately for the public, I have another reason to be here today, such that the cost has been minimized. I thank the courts for its attention and would reserve what time is available for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Vaughn?
The government's position in this matter is that the district court had the authority to order Ms. Havens to pay the restitution. This is a case in which we have an offense involving fraud and deceit that involved a scheme. Ms. Brown was directly harmed as a result of that, and she suffered a pecuniary loss.
Putting to one side the what difference does it make point that Judge Easterbrook has raised, it does seem that this $30,000 figure that the state court judge came up with was more or less pulled out of a hat. That's fine. That's state law. There probably were ways of making sure it was, you know, not a due process violation or anything. But restitution under the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act is something for which there needs to be a factual basis. And I was troubled by the fact that there is no clear source of this 30,000 number. The government's coming up with 26,000. Other people were coming up with 1,500. Other people, you know, she came up at one point with more than $500,000. I don't know whether you're saying that this is her consequential damages, whether it's the lawyers she had to hire to go clear her credit record. The judge says something about it not being attorney's fees. It's as clear as mud, actually, and I don't think the court can order restitution without making a record what's being restored, if you will.
Your Honor is correct. The record is not clear on the basis of the $30,000 reward.
So, if we thought it made a difference and we don't do something along the lines that Judge Easterbrook is talking about, how can this possibly stand? Now, it may be a bigger number. I don't know that the defendant is going to be assisted by challenging this lack of a basis, but how can we let things stand where they are?
Well, I think where we started out, you're correct, that there are a large number of divergent numbers over what should be the restitution. And I think when we actually get down into the meat of the sentencing hearing, the government's argument is $1,500 as the out-of-pocket expense that Ms. Havens incurred in attempting to investigate what had happened to her credit record.
But that's not even her out-of-pocket expense. The $1,500 was her, in a sense, her hourly rate. You know, that was the number of hours times what she says her time is worth. That wasn't, you know, whether she had to get in her car and drive and talk to somebody or make a phone call or hire an investigator or a lawyer to make phone calls on her behalf. There are all kinds of other things she might have had to do.
Let me ask a variation of that. If she had brought a lawsuit against the United States and prevailed, would she be entitled under the Equal Access to Justice Act to $2,500 or $1,500 to cover the opportunity cost of her time, even though there was no out-of-pocket expense?
Not by opportunity cost, meaning like similar to her bill here where she
That's what her claim was, that $1,500 was the opportunity cost of her time, the value of the time devoted to this litigation, not an out-of-pocket cost, but the value of putting it to other uses instead. Right? Opportunity cost claims have been fairly common under the Equal Access to Justice Act and, for that matter, under other fee-shifting statutes, and the Supreme Court has held that they're no good, that those kinds of statutes are limited to out-of-pocket costs, and one wonders why the restitution statute is not similarly limited to out-of-pocket costs.
I guess my answer would be that under the subsection B4 of the 3663A, it refers to lost income.
Yes.
and that she is entitled to be.
And an opportunity cost is different in principle from income.
Based on that argument, I would say she's not entitled to an opportunity cost because the statute says you get your lost
income.
Well,
we're now down to zero because it now looks like everything in the state judgment represents consequential or compensatory damages because it's hard to see anything else.
But
unless, unless restitution covers compensatory damages, where do
right.
we go?
Well, or maybe you could explain, I mean, whether the 26,000 number you came up with in your supplement to the sentencing memorandum was either duplicative of what was in the state court judgment or whether it was something else. I mean, I just simply cannot deal with this case on the record that, that we have here.
Okay. As far as the record on the restitution issue, I mean, I'll be very candid with the court. I fell asleep at the switch on the restitution. The focus was on the upward departure going up on an incremental increase based on the upward departure grounds for the substantial inconvenience and the harm to the victim's credit record. The pre-sentence investigation report, the victim had some numbers that were set forth in that report that said, this is how much I've paid out, this is how much this has cost me, and I think my recollection is that's where that 26
That's where the 26. So what about these monies that she paid out, apart from her state court litigation? She has her state court litigation, and that's over in one corner. What about the money she paid out to restore her good credit rating? Is that compensable under this statute as far as you're concerned?
If we look at a traditional straight definition or examination of pecuniary loss, no. However, if we look at the way the restitution statute is written, you have to suffer a pecuniary loss to qualify for restitution. And then the statute lists out various costs that can be, restituted. And I guess the question becomes, are those strictly straight pecuniary matters, or is it something else? And that's where I think if we look at other provisions in the restitution statute, for example, the bodily harm, where you can get restitution, where you have specific categories within that criteria, the Husky case out of the 11th Circuit, there the court said, because Congress set forth specific categories, that's all you get. District court, you can't order restitution for other things. But under the other expenses provision of the restitution statute, we don't have that. And what does the other expenses mean? In a case of identity theft, I think there are an awful lot of expenses, such as those which were incurred by Ms. Brown, that are going to naturally flow from a case of identity theft.
Do you think it cost her $30,000 out of pocket to get new credit card numbers and the like?
That's what the attorney, Ms. Brown, went and retained counsel rather than directly or initially going to the government. In connection with the civil lawsuit, which I would submit one portion of that
was. The civil lawsuit found that your attorney's fees were $14,000, but you agree that that's not compensable under the restitution statute.
That's correct. She had asked for many more than $14,000. I believe it was a figure that was huge. It was something like $30,000-some-odd that the attorney then took an appeal to try to get more than the $14,000 and get the, I think it was $30,000, that was rejected by the Indiana Court of Appeals, and the transfer was denied by the Indiana Supreme Court. I'm sure there's a lot of disagreement whether those kind of fees are appropriate in a case like this, were they appropriately earned or whatever. I don't know if that is really before this court, because that was not the basis of the restitution award. If there are any other questions from the court, the government.
Well, yes. Having listened to your exchange with my colleagues, maybe I missed something, but can you give us any addition or subtraction in the record that reflects? I'll make it easy. Close to 30,000. I mean, what do we find? Can we find it?
No. I can't get you to 30. I can get you to 1,500. And I can't get you beyond that.
No, I suspect, and I appreciate.
And I suppose for a government whose budget is measured in the hundreds of billions, 1,500 and 30,000 have to be the same number.
You're not required to comment on that.
Very well. That being said, If the court has no other questions, the government would stand on its brief.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Stacey?
All
right, thanks to both counsel, and the case is taken under advisement, and we'll proceed to the